can hear the furniture moving in the background.
Yeah, it's me.
Okay, so this intro is going to be quick and a little more serious than usual. Today, we're going to be talking with Anthony Fenton, who is a Canadian journalist and a specialist in Canadian foreign policy, and the co-author of a book called Waging War on the Poor Majority, Canada and Haiti. And he's going to be elaborating on the situation in Haiti right now and explaining how it relates to Canadian imperialism. Hopefully folks will enjoy this. I know Steve, too, is stoked.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just busy, so I'm probably not even going to really be around. But we've talked to him before, haven't we?
Yep, we interviewed him, and he's really knowledgeable about the Canadian foreign policy, and folks should stay tuned. He did an interview with Democracy Now! About this topic a few years ago when Aristide was forcibly removed. So I'm going to bring him on right now, folks. Hopefully this will work. Anthony?
Yes.
Okay, let me turn up the volume on you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Can you speak a little louder?
I can try, yeah. Is that better?
That's much better.
Great.
So today we have you on air to discuss Haiti. So I guess I'm going to start right off with a question. And I'm wondering if you could briefly describe what's going on in Haiti right now.
Okay, that's a big question. Yeah. Obviously, 6 days ago, at around 5 p.m. Eastern, I believe, Haiti was devastated by this 7.0-plus earthquake. And, destroying basically a country that was struggling under military occupation, struggling with a history of foreign intervention and imperialism, and we still don't know the full extent of the devastation. Already, we're hearing on the ground today there are reports that some 70,000 bodies have been buried in mass graves. That there could be upwards of another well over 100,000 people who are dead. You've had the highest number of UN employees ever killed in a single incident, killed in this earthquake. You've got many Canadian nationals, many U.S. nationals dead or missing. The Canadian head of the U.S. The UN occupation police forces was killed as he met with a Chinese police contingent. Another Canadian RCMP officer died. You've got what we've got right now flooding into Haiti. You've got the Haitian government signed a memorandum of understanding with the U.S. military, essentially the Pentagon, handing over control, sovereignty over its airspace and its airport to the U.S. military. You've got a number of disputes that are emerging over the U.S. military's handling of cargo and airplanes that are trying to get desperately needed aid into Haiti. You've had the U.S. military turn away Doctors Without Borders flights and other flights. There's questions that they might be trying to divert or prevent Cuban and Venezuelan humanitarian supplies from getting in, and so forth. There's expected to be more than 10,000 U.S. soldiers on the ground this week. There's going to be more than 2,000 Canadian forces personnel, all told, including the disaster relief team that's underway, getting on the ground there sometime this week, and as well as other military forces. These are in addition to the nearly 10,000 UN occupation forces who were already on the ground, but according to many reports, are basically invisible as far as the relief efforts go. Number of UN soldiers, especially Brazilians, 11 Brazilians were killed, a number of others. Various reports are trickling. The situation is so chaotic because of a lack of electricity, a number of the phone lines were downed, communications incredibly difficult, the diaspora, the Haitian diaspora, you know, it's just incredibly difficult for many people even to know whether family members are alive or dead at this point. For the most part, it was the center, the city center, the capital city, Port-au-Prince, that was that most devastated by the earthquake. Exacerbating the problem was the fact that so many people from the countryside, you know, Haiti is a traditionally and agriculturally rurally based society. So many people over the past decades have had to flood into the city centers because, you know, as a direct result of U.S. policies that have undermined Haiti's agricultural system. For example, you know, they used to be sustainable with self-sustainable with rice production and so forth, but flooding the market with the American rice has ruined that, and this in turn forces many people into the cities. So there's upwards of 3 million people living in Port-au-Prince, as I said, exacerbating the problem, creating a population density that is only, all the more worse off in a situation like this because of that. And then Jacmel in the south, one of Haiti's tourist areas, apparently has been very hard hit. Very few reports have come out of there, and it's almost impossible for aid convoys to reach Jacmel, and so we simply don't know the full extent of the devastation, but it's going to be just a massive, unthinkable human toll. And as far as what little infrastructure Haiti had, everyone's obviously been watching reports and listening to various reports, so I'm not describing anything new here, but it's just, I've visited Haiti just twice in the last few years, since the coup d'etat in 2004 that overthrew Aristide, and knowing what I know, having been on the ground, I can just, it's almost hard to picture the level of devastation there today.
Anthony, you mentioned the U.S. military and the U.S. military's role in providing what's being described as aid is being discussed by the progressive media and the mainstream media. I wonder if you could focus in on Canada's relationship with Haiti over the 20th century and into the 21st.
Right. I'm not as familiar as I'd like to be with, say, Canada's role, like, because Canada's had that, I think Canada celebrated its 50th year anniversary of diplomatic relations with Haiti in when Paul Martin was Prime Minister in 2004. In fact, Martin used the occasion to be the first Canadian Prime Minister ever to grace Haiti with their presence in visiting the country in November 2004. But what we know is that it's been a controversial relationship right from the get-go. Canadian supported, in effect, the latter part, at least, of the Duvalier dictatorship period, supporting baby Doc Duvalier, sending aid to aid and abet his totalitarian regime that ended in the 1980s. And since then, this is the important period leading up to the present day, since baby Doc led the country in the mid-80s, 1986. The U.S. U.S.-led policy has been to basically try and create a condition where there's a level of stability, that is a stability in the interest of maintaining elite rule over Haiti. Historically, Haiti is unique in this hemisphere, especially in the Caribbean, as having the greatest concentration of wealth in the fewest hands. And you have a historically corrupt and greedy elite in Haiti that has aligned itself with the power brokers in Washington. And Canada's policy has been to very closely align itself with U.S. policy. And especially since the first coup d'etat against Aristide, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was elected in 1990 and subsequently overthrown in a U.S.-backed military coup, ever since the Clinton administration returned Aristide to power with a number of caveats and a number of strings attached, namely to try and finally impose the what was then emerging as the Washington Consensus, the neoliberal plan for Haiti to so-called democratize Haiti in the fashion of creating a sort of pseudo neoliberal state where the elites maintain control, you have a fig leaf of democracy, but always in the interest of U.S. Foreign policy, U.S. imperialism, creating free trade zones, creating a number of sweatshops where Haitians can labor over stitching baseballs and T-shirts at the cost of pennies an hour to these corporations that then get shipped up to the North American markets at astronomical profits. Canada's policy has been in lockstep with the U.S. policy more or less since then, especially since Canada joined the Organization of American States in the late 1980s. And the period I focused most closely on is the period between coups leading up to the coup in 2004, which of course was unlike the first coup in 1991. The coup in 2004 was sold as a non-coup. It was sold as dictatorial slide into chaos under Jean-Bertrand Aristide, much like the international media likes to characterize Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez today. They increasingly began to paint this caricature of Jean-Bertrand Aristide when he was reelected in the year 2000 as a dictator hell-bent on power, as someone who lost the support of the masses, who turned against the masses, etc., who was corrupt. And the Canadian media, along with especially the U.S. media, led this charge in demonizing him. And on the policy side, the Canadian policy, I've written about this in a couple of articles, and as have others, and it's documented quite clearly by now with documents we've obtained through access to information requests and elsewhere, that especially inside the OAS, for example, from the period 2001 to 2003, the U.S. and Canada in particular deliberately undermined the Aristide government, preventing vital aid, vital loans that had already been guaranteed to them, which they needed to basically feed the population and so forth, and implement just rudimentary programs to lift up the population and begin to democratize and so forth legitimately. The Canadian and U.S. government undermined this, preventing this critical aid from reaching the Haitian government, weakening it, lending to the process of destabilizing it, alongside a different process, a parallel track of destabilization that involved Haiti's elite in conjunction with Haiti's former military, which Aristide had disbanded in the mid-90s. This paramilitary squad began making incursions into Haiti in 2001, and increasingly in lockstep with the elites, although it wasn't reported at the time, these paramilitaries invaded in early 2004 from the Dominican Republic, where they're housed and possibly in complicity with or in direct support by U.S. intelligence agencies. They then destabilized the situation to the extent that the U.S. was provided with a pretext to send special forces in, who then essentially kidnapped Aristide in the dead of night on February 29, 2004. And Canadians arrived to secure the airport almost simultaneously. And, of course, the coup d'etat happened. And then, since then, Haiti was thrown into yet another period of chaos and repression. You know, thousands, between 2004 and 2006 in particular, when there was an interim, what they called an interim government in place, they basically flew in a new prime minister from Florida, who'd been living in Florida, a U.S. puppet, U.S. and Canada and France-backed puppet, who then oversaw a regime of repression that killed thousands of popular supporters of Aristide, because contrary to the false narrative that the media was conveying, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Aristide actually did enjoy the support of the masses, even though elite sectors were able to mobilize some semblance of an opposition that the media, of course, blew out of proportion. Many, many sectors of Haiti's civil society still supported Aristide, so the quietly of the media. The media refused to report on it at the time. Death squads roamed the streets, and they restored a different kind of order under U.S., Canadian, and French occupation that lasted until mid-2004, after which it was taken over by the Brazilians, who continue to this day to control the country. But in 2006, Canada supported the election of René Préval, even though at the same time Canada's preferred candidate was somebody who was more selected, hand-selected from the elite sectors. Préval was a former prime minister of Aristides. Préval, of course, was president after Aristides' first term. But Préval has clearly taken a turn toward the U.S.-Canada sort of vision for Haiti, and he's become effectively their own puppet, in the sense that he's implemented a lot of the policies that they've been striving to implement. You know, World Bank structural adjustment type policies, privatizing Haiti's few state-run sectors, such as the telecommunications company. Literally 5 days before the coup, 70% of the teleco company was sold off to private corporations. And, you know, this is the sort of process that Canada's been part of. I'm going on a bit here, but this is, in a nutshell, Canadian support for, you know, undermining what was a fragile but young popular democracy, undermining that in place of this 21st century neoliberal quote-unquote democracy that's more conducive to Western capitalist and transnational corporate interests. And that's where that's the prelude to this earthquake. You know, so in 2004 in particular, you know, Haiti took us another huge step backwards at a time when they were already struggling day-to-day life, struggling to put in place the, you know, planting the seeds of democracy, so to speak, popular democracy. Coup d'etat happens, wipes out, and you know, one thing that happened to wipe out was a disaster response unit that they'd been trying to set up, and you know, just made them all the more susceptible to disasters like this. And of course, this isn't the first natural disaster that they've had since 2004. They've had a hurricane that kills a couple of people in Cuba, will kill hundreds, if not thousands, of people in Haiti because of the lack of infrastructure, that their inability to cope with such disasters. Again, this is all rooted in Haiti's history, the history of colonialism and imperialism and neo-imperialism that exists up to the present day.
In your discussion of the history of intervention in Haiti, you touched on how all these interventions have essentially exacerbated the current situation there through neoliberal privatizations of infrastructure, etc., in order to create some Canadian and U.S. imperialist vision for Haiti. What would that look like, that vision?
Well, it's beginning to look like it now. I mean, for example, one of the things that companies like Gildan Activewear, the largest T-shirt manufacturer in the world, they need an environment that is stable, and their version of stability is where they know that they have a president and a parliament in place that isn't going to rock the boat. Status quo of Haiti being the basically the floor for wages in the hemisphere. As you know, Kevin Pina, a colleague who reports for Flashpoints and Haiti Action Network, has noted time and again, the very fact of Haiti being the floor is critical in the hemisphere, because if Haiti's wage levels were to increase, you would no longer have the threat. For example, if you also have factories in Honduras or Mexico or Guatemala, you would never no longer be able to threaten those workers with moving operations to Haiti. And that's one. That's a critical component of the sweatshop paradigm that is a part of this vision, this neoliberal vision for Haiti. I visited sweatshops there. You know, Andy Aped is one of the owners of one of the sweatshops, one of the Gildan-owned sweatshops. And Andy Ped was the poster child for the movement, the Group of 184 movement, that helped overthrow Aristide in 2004. And so it's very symbolic of, he's symbolic of the vision we're talking about, and he's symbolic of the overall effort to implement this. Now, the other, another side of it is Haiti's unknown natural resource potential. You know, one of the supporters of Guy Philippe, who's the key paramilitary figure who basically led the, in many ways, a fake paramilitary incursion into Haiti, because the reality was that Haitian popular organizations were set to defend Port-au-Prince and the National Palace in particular from this paramilitary invasion in 2004, but he was the key pretext for the U.S.-led invasion that forced Aristide out. But one of the Canadian corporations who met with Philippe and may very well have helped finance his destabilization was a mineral company that had the rights to explore for gold in the northern part of Haiti. And since then, they've passed their holdings over to other Canadian companies, and there's a number of Canadian mining companies operating in Haiti, much like they operate in other third world countries, especially in Latin America, and basically pillaging the natural resources at immense profits and with little or any regard for the population under whose feet the resources happen to be. And the only way that you can do that is if you have a government that's not going to counter you, that's not going to keep you in check, and that's exactly what these types of interventions have been aiming for, is to have our guys in office to be sure that they're under our thumb. And the other thing is to literally have what we've had in Haiti, even since Préval was elected in 2006, is a de facto trusteeship, a de facto sharing of Haiti's sovereignty. And like, that's what it's taken for them to implement their plan. And so what it looks like, again, is getting back, you know, privatizing the sectors that haven't been privatized, democratizing the basically streamlining the ministries of government in a way that's most conducive to the implementation of neoliberal policies, signing on the dotted line for the IMF, World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, structural adjustment type programs, and so forth. And then the other, you know, there's also fears as far as the vision for Haiti, right? I mean, right now there's fears again that have been stoked with the arrival of all these forces, as Haiti as a launching pad for destabilization and continuing Western military and economic hegemony for the entire hemisphere. So there's credible fears voiced by Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega and then Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez just yesterday, that they're trying to use this as an opportunity to gain a military foothold in Haiti in light, in advance of a prospective destabilization effort in South America. So, you know, you've had this question of military bases being established by the U.S. in Colombia, frustration by the U.S. that popular movements have been growing in the region, and so this would be a perfect opportunity, some say, for the U.S. to establish a military foothold in Haiti and the region, of course, also to help destabilize neighboring Cuba and so forth. And these are credible concerns, and these are all part of the same package, and that's basically it in a nutshell, as far as I can see.
You mentioned the turning Haiti into essentially like a giant U.S. military base, but even before the earthquake, I read there was up to 80 RCMP officers in Haiti, and recently one died in the earthquake. So I guess it's appeared in the mainstream media that there has been an RCMP presence in Haiti. I'm wondering if you could discuss why the RCMP is there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the decision, that one of the decisions that the Canadian state made, especially as they were increasing the tempo and presence of Canadian forces in Afghanistan. I mean, Haiti is the main operational model of counterinsurgency operations found in Canada's counterinsurgency operations manual that was released by the Canadian forces at the end of 2008. RCMP have actually had more or less a continual presence in Haiti since the first invasion in 1994, which returned Aristide. It gets back to this notion of establishing a quote-unquote democratic policing environment within Haiti in the mold of on the one hand, you could say in the mold of the Canadian-style policing, but also, really, in reality, it's in the mold of these sort of 1980s-style national security states, these terrorist regimes that the U.S. propped up throughout Latin America in the 1970s and 1980s, because, Canadian RCMP have been basically propping up and training a Haitian police force whose primary function is to repress popular movements and to repress what they call criminal gangs. So all these criminal gangs happen to be, popular organizations comprised of mostly young Haitians who are, struggling to live and who are struggling to feed their families, who live in the popular neighborhoods that are anti-occupation and supporting the return of exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and that's been the case for years. That was part of the first invasion in the 1990s, part of the first coup d'état. I mean, when Aristide was, what has to be understood is that there was a, when Aristide was elected on the backs of a massive popular movement, the likes of which the hemisphere had not seen in a long time, and the military coup in 1991, thousands of popular activists were killed in an attempt to literally kill the popular movement, but it didn't kill the popular movement. In fact, there's also the case, it's clear in U.S. policy planning documents and so forth, analysis I've seen since then, that Clinton invaded and brought Aristide back as a way of preventing a revolution that may very well have taken place had they not kicked out the military regime and returned Aristide. And of course, we know that that's the ever-present threat of a good example in Haiti or in any country is a popular movement, especially leftist in orientation, that seeks to impose or implement literal democracy, popular democracy. So that's part of what the main criteria and the main objective of Canadian RCMP in Haiti have been, to create this kind of sort of, not even really a police force, sort of a paramilitary type force that first and foremost polices the population in a way that keeps the lid on things, as they say. I mean, the Canadian contingent there, we interviewed Canadian police commander in Haiti in 2005, and it's very clear that this, what we think of as police, we see the cruisers in our neighborhoods and people being pulled over for speeding and so forth, or in Vancouver where they're quite recognized, quite repressive against the poor and the indigenous and the homeless and so forth. But really in Haiti, a lot of these police were literal paramilitary units, and so the police, that the Canadian police would be alongside the Haitian police, who would be alongside the UN military, and they conduct what they call operations, and they have a name for these called formed police units, and they would literally go and launch invasions into popular neighborhoods where so-called gang leaders are existing, and they would bomb them, kill, and they kill, they were accused of killing numerous civilians in the process. And Canadians, if they aren't literally involved, they're actually in the command positions alongside, and And the Canadians, with the Canadian International Development Agency funding, have been building police stations. They've been building, writing down the strategic plan for the Haitian National Police. It's literally been written by Canadians and implemented with their oversight and with their tutelage. And so this is really the thumbnail sketch of Canadian policing efforts. You know, first and foremost, to repress the population or help the police learn how to properly and quote-unquote democratically repress the population, and to assist military efforts and to again, just impose a certain kind of Western-conceived law and order on the state. And that partly that's been playing into the problems we're seeing on the ground today, is that the police are nowhere to be seen. They're protecting wealthier neighborhoods. Their primary function is to keep the population from the wealthy, keep the population away from the occupation forces, and keep them repressed. And that's unfortunately what we're seeing play out, you know, as we speak. Is we see these horrible stories of how aid is not reaching the poorest sectors.
This counterinsurgency model that you just described, would this resemble the type of Latin American death squads you would have seen in the 80s in countries like Nicaragua or Guatemala?
Right now, it's hard to say. There haven't been a lot of reports of death squad activity, even before the earthquake. But during the period 2004 to 2006, most certainly there were death squads operating with impunity. There were eyewitness reports of police wearing ski masks, firing at demonstrations, you know, calling for foreign forces out or Aristide return, but no evidence that I've seen of Canadian support for death squad activity. But it's really it's just a question of complicity. And in fact, there was and it's also turning the blind eye, right? There was a Harvard University report in 2005 where investigators, forensic experience, literally went and found mass graves where Haitian activists had been murdered and dumped. And when they went to Canadian police commanders and asked them, do you know about these deaths, these mass graves, or what are you going to do about them? They literally got no response. And the Canadians basically said, no, there's nothing we care or are willing to do about it. And, I've heard sentiments expressed by Canadians in Haiti along the lines of, you know, just really all I can say is anti-people. You know, for example, you take Cité Soleil, which is one of the most densely packed and largest slums in the Western world, in the hemisphere. And the sentiments were such that, you know, these people are subhuman. These people, if we had the political will to do so, we would just drive them into the ocean and start from scratch, sort of thing. And it's interesting to hear that sentiment several years ago now, and then see the devastation that this earthquake has caused. And you can see how, and we've seen this expressed in the sentiment of right-wing think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, just in the past few days, saying that out of this crisis, there's an opportunity for the West. You know, there's opportunities, the hand of God, so to speak, the earthquake, has created for us opportunities to reconstruct the Haitian state in ways that wouldn't have been possible if we were to have gone out and bulldozed certain parts of the country. You know, and so, like, there's these really cynical, really, right-wing mentalities that are sensing an opportunity in Haiti's new round of devastation to implement, you know, partly this, you'll see the narrative in some of the critical alternative media of disaster capitalism. But I mean, for some of these right-wing fantasies, it's disaster capitalism in the extreme. You know, ridding Haiti of the poor in a way that they couldn't have done so militarily or through their counterinsurgency methods or what have you. And this is sort of the frightening aspects of this, and just speaks to the need for people to empower themselves with, you know, this context, Haiti's historical context, to get in touch to the extent possible with popular organizations on the ground, and in turn with the solidarity organizations in Canada and the U.S., like Canada Haiti Action Network, with the Haiti Action Network, with credible organizations like Paul Farmers, Partners in Health, and so forth. You know, we can list them, we can tick them off, but it's critical that instead of just sort of blindly giving money to, you know, Red Cross, what have you, which may very well be an important thing to do right now. I'm certainly not going to discourage anyone from doing that, but to spend some time researching and getting in contact with the organizations that are all going to be organizing public forums in the very near future across Canada, and getting engaged with what exactly Canada's been doing, what exactly Canada's plans are. We hear actually next Monday, that's been announced today, Canada's going to be holding a summit on Haiti in Montreal. And so, we can go back to 2000, January 2000, 2001, I'm getting my dates mixed up, when Canada held the fabled Ottawa Initiative on Haiti meeting, a secret meeting of Westerners and Europeans to discuss Haiti's future without any Haitians invited. Now, there may be some Haitians invited to Montreal next week, but make no mistake, Canada, France, and the U.S. are going to be the ones who think that they can determine just what kind of help Haiti needs to reconstruct when in fact, as Patrick Ely, the former Haitian Minister of Defense, who's spoken across Canada against the coup and in support of Haitian sovereignty, has said it should be the Haitian people who are deciding how their country is rebuilt. They should be the ones leading it. If anything, at this point, you know, Canada, we need less meddling of the international community, as they call themselves, and reparations and support for Haitian sovereignty. Getting a little bit off your topic there, but I'll round that up.
That was excellent. You mentioned aid, and I was wondering if you could expand on aid, and especially aid in Haiti is a tool of imperialism.
Yeah, one of the problems, of course, and you know, people like Eve Engler and Nick Berryshaw and others have pointed to this, is the NGOification of aid and aid implementation. I mean, even the Canadian International Development Agency, you know, albeit a year and a half after the coup in 2004, it admitted after the fact, openly in one of its documents, that bypassing the Haitian government and giving its money to NGOs functioned to destabilize the democratically elected government. And so, in fact, Haiti, I think it's Eve Engler has pointed out in a recent article, Haiti has one of the highest numbers of NGOs per capita of any country in the world. And you have, and when that's the case, you take all control out of the government's hands, the state's hands, and essentially out of the people's hands. You know, when you have thousands of different NGOs with thousands of different mandates with no coordinated effort, many times with this paternalistic sort of, white man's burden type mentality. Not to say that they all have that, but, you know, my point is that very disparate the efforts, many well-intentioned people there, but also, and then you also have the political NGOs in particular funded by Canada, the U.S., and the so-called democracy promotion NGOs that were critical in undermining and helping to destabilize the government, and then after the fact, critical in empowering Haiti's elite sectors and putting more power into their hands and so forth. And these are the people who implement the so-called aid money. So very, very little of the money that's supposedly poured into Haiti. You know, we're told that many billions of dollars have been poured into Haiti since 2004 in particular. Very little of it goes into the hands of the people who know how to, who know the most about how to implement it. And very, very little of it goes into the hands of the Haitian people themselves to empower them to decide their own fate, decide their own future, decide how to rebuild their own communities, and so forth. And so, in short, and the question of NGOs and aid is a big, complex, again, historical one. But these are some of the crux of the problems and the consequences of the NGOification of aid delivery and that's really that's bound up with this whole trusteeship notion that they've been implementing since 2004 is the Préval government itself has complained, like, you're giving the money, you say you're giving aid to Haiti, but you're giving aid to NGOs, and so much of the aid, like, there's a net amount, right, and there's a gross amount of money that goes in, and so much of the money is what they call tied aid, in that X cents on the dollar doesn't even go to Haiti. It goes to pay the salaries of the foreign nationals who are working on the ground in Haiti. So the thousands of NGOs have thousands of employees driving around in thousands of white SUVs, and that's aid money that's fueling those vehicles and paying for the hotels or the apartments or the homes of the people who are living there. And so, again, that's just money that's going diverted away from where it most critically needs to go. And that's sort of the crux of the problem. And, of course, it's bound up with the broader question of what we call 21st century imperialism.
Thanks, Anthony. We have about 10 minutes left. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to say that you think would help everyone's understanding of what's going on in Haiti right now?
I think just the main thing is just information-wise. One of the on my website, which I'll mention, is webofdemocracy.org. I've just been trying to day to day keep up with things. It's in this 24-hour news cycle with all the tweeting, twittering going on. I'm doing that too. It's a very difficult just to keep track of what's going on, and a lot of people may end up just relying on CBC's televised report or Fox News or whatever, but I would encourage people to just to rely on outlets like Al Jazeera. I know reporters who are reporting for Al Jazeera, and they're way more trustworthy than the Anderson Coopers of the world, and this is the disaster media disaster complex we're seeing in motion too. So it's very important to, as I said before, seek out credible organizations, because absolutely Haiti needs resources. They need cash to get in the hands of credible organizations. As important as that is, there's also war for a narrative and information going on right now. So there's the thing that's most disturbing I found in the media is just the lack of historical context that's provided, or just this glossing over of Canada's real role in Haiti. You can just throw a dart at the mainstream coverage, and you can see that there's no recognition of Canada's involvement in the coup d'état in 2004 of a negative role. All you see is just this patronizing narrative of how much Canada can do to help Haiti and how well positioned Canada is to help Haiti, when in fact most of our policies have been quite harmful for the country, especially in this most recent history. And so just encourage people to check out Al Jazeera, for example. Anyone can download go to livestation.com and download the portal there that gives you free 24/7 coverage of events down there. And then go to websites like the Canada Haiti Action Network and HaitiAction.net. And just get on top of what's really going on there, and do what you can. Participate. There's going to be through Canada Haiti Action. People will become aware of events that are taking place in Vancouver. We had Stu Hammond of the Canada Haiti Action Network just came back from Haiti. He left just a few days before the earthquake, and he's giving report backs. Members of the Haitian community in Montreal and Ottawa are. They're giving presentations, and their writings and so forth are available through those websites. And so just people to empower themselves and do what they can to do so. I mean, this is the time, and what's going to happen with this media disaster complex is that attention very quickly is going to go away when what the Haitian people realize themselves is a long-term struggle to get their society back together. And so people just don't turn your attention away, even though the media is going to basically expect you to, or it's going to divert your attention to something else. Try and get involved, and you know, Haiti needs solidarity more than anything over the long term. And anybody who can commit themselves to that is doing a great, great service to themselves and people of Haiti, I think.
Thanks for talking with us today, Anthony. And we should do this again.
Yeah, you bet. Anytime. Thank you so much.
Have a good day, man.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Success in this business is directly linked to effective duplication. So lead by example.
Yeah. Your whole thug abilities anti-climatic village idiot. Bubonic plague.